Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Novelist and Navy SEAL Jack Carr joins us for a really interesting conversation. Man, this guy's seen a lot, knows a lot. News coming as well. First, I'll tell you about LifeLock. Tax season is scary enough. Now the IRS is warning about ghost tax preparers who don't sign as the paid preparer and could be red flagged. It's important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives. Every day we put our info at risk on the internet. In an instant, cyber criminals could harm your finances and your credit. Good thing there's LifeLock. LifeLock detects a wide range of identity threats like your social security number for sale on the dark web. If they detect your information has potentially been compromised, they'll send you an alert. You have access to a dedicated restoration specialist. Right, Dawson?
No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but you can keep what's yours, yours with LifeLock Identity Theft Protection. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year at LifeLock.com. Promo code Adam. That's LifeLock.com. Promo code Adam for 25% off.
And now, a totally innocuous word that sounds dirty when Mike Dawson says it.
Slippery.
Ew. Let's get back to the Adam Carolla Show.
Navy SEAL. I don't want to say former Navy SEAL. You're always a Navy SEAL when you're a Navy SEAL.
It's usually the Marines that have a hard time with that. It's the former Marine thing that that really trips you up sometimes. But former SEAL is fine, I think, with most of us.
Jack Carr's his name. The Devil's Hand, a thriller, available now on Amazon, everybody. And it's the fourth thriller and the pulse-pounding Terminal List series. Also, he has a podcast, Danger Close with Jack Carr. Good to meet you, Jack.
Great to meet you too. Actually, I was scheduled to come on last year, right around the time the pandemic hit. So it was like right in mid-April, and then all of a sudden, everything shut down, travel banned. And so I'm glad we're doing it now. It's great to hang out with you guys.
Well, look, we finally figured out how to do this. Now we're all used to it.
There it is. Yep.
20 years with the Navy SEALs, team leader, platoon commander, troop commander, led teams in the Philippines, Afghanistan. What about the Philippines? What's going on with the Navy SEALs in the Philippines?
Yeah, so we had a task force that got put together right after September 11th, and we had a relationship already with that government and in that area of the world well before September 11th, obviously. But they've been fighting an insurgency in that southern island chain for over 100 years now, and there were elements of Al Qaeda. Actually, 9/11, the plan was hatched in the Philippines. A lot of people don't know that. It was approved in Afghanistan, but there was the actual plan came, that was in 1994-95. They started hatching this plan out there. They were going to bomb these planes that were headed in the Pacific, taking off from Australia and New Zealand and places like that. And they were all going to explode essentially at the same time mid-flight. There was a fire in an apartment in Manila, and the plan got thwarted only because of that fire. But the plan was hatched there, approved in Afghanistan. And then, of course, a lot of the training and the planning took place in Hamburg, Germany, San Diego, California, Phoenix, Arizona. So it's it was international in scope.
Well, let's get back to that original plan. That sounds chilling.
Yeah, it's called Bojinka, Plan Bojinka is what it was called. And part of that was the assassination of the Pope in the Philippines, also in January of 1995. So it was coordinated and ready to go. So without that fire in Manila in December, I think, of 1994, that probably would have happened.
How many planes did they have slated for
I think
the explosion?
So what they found in that fire is they got a computer and they got the hard drives from that computer. They exploited that intelligence. I'd have to go back and look, but it was several planes mid-flight over the Pacific. So yeah, quite not one. I'd say more than one and less than 10, so somewhere in there.
And it was, but how did the fire then give way to the good guys finding out the information?
the fire department came, and two people in the apartment ran. And I think one was apprehended, one got away. He was later apprehended in Pakistan with the Department of the Department of Security Services. DSS got them in Pakistan later that year. But yeah, it was a fire. They were either building a bomb or it was an accident. I've read both things. But fire department came. These guys looked spooky. They ran, and then they recovered this this device and started looking into it, and then it fell apart from there.
Wow. Hmm. Well, you know, we have a Filipino producer on this show. I didn't know that your homeland was also the birthplace of terrorism.
Yeah.
But what good news, if your country didn't have such shoddy wiring codes, the apartment would have never caught on fire, and we'd have a bunch of dead Australians. So tip of the cap.
Thank you.
For that.
It's possible. It's possible.
Wow. So you're deployed there in that year or shortly shortly after?
A little after. So right on September 11th, I was in Guam. It was my second deployment. And in Guam, it was about the middle of the night, and people start banging on doors in the barracks up and down the hallway. And we had a TV in the basement, so the whole platoon met down there, and we watched the Twin Towers fall on TV. And of course, we thought we were going right to Afghanistan the next day. But the U.S. military and political establishment being what it is, it's a gigantic bureaucracy. And it took a little while to get things off the ground. So we ended up flying to the Middle East probably a few weeks later. And we thought once again we were going into Afghanistan. But what we did was enforce the UN embargo against Iraq, the oil embargo. So we boarded ships in what was then called the Northern Arabian Gulf. They'd head out of Iraq, take a sharp left-hand turn for Iranian waters, and we'd have to climb on, board them, and turn them around and get them back into international waters before they hit Iran. So that's what we did right afterward.
Bouncer.
That's it. A lot of guys went right into Afghanistan, though, but I ended up there about a year later.
What kind of ships were you boarding?
Everything from small dhows to the gigantic class three tankers. So at the time I was an enlisted SEAL sniper. And so I'm on the bridge of these things. And what they would do is they would take barbed wire and take it and string it all over the ship. So if you came in a helicopter and dropped off this fast rope, it would get tangled up in this barbed wire. So you couldn't go in that way.
You couldn't rappel down.
Right. Fast rope is like holding on and you just slide down, but similar to the same thing.
Right.
And then, so we'd go in and so they'd wait till the worst weather, middle of the night, and they'd head out, and then they'd take the sharp left-hand turn for Iran, and we'd have to zoom up on the sides with boats, climb on board, and then they'd take all the ladders that are on ships, so you can climb up these different levels. They saw those off, and then all the doors and windows, they welded on these different sheets of metal so that you had to then take your exothermic torch and saws, get through that, get inside, figure out how to turn this thing around, and get it back in about, you had about 15 or 20 minutes to do that.
Wow. So the boat, let me just see if we can paint the picture. It's nighttime.
Yep.
Terrible weather.
Terrible weather, and the boat's moving at a full clip. I mean, they're not going half speed. They're going as fast as they can go. And you're pulling up next to them in what kind of craft?
Like a smaller, it's called a rigid hull inflatable boat. So it's like 33 feet? Anyway, it's like a small rubber boat, and you can fit it, I don't know, 8, 10, 11 guys on there, something like that. And you had a couple of them, and you'd zoom up alongside, and then you'd throw these ladders up and hook in the middle of the night, pull the hook away, and it would unroll this little thing called a caving ladder, which is about that big. And then you'd climb up this thing, banging off the side of the ship, hoping that it's holding up there with this little tiny hook on it. And get over the side and then clear that ship.
How soon would they know that somebody had boarded the ship? Would they see you coming or no?
I don't know if they would see us coming on their radar or not, or if they had some early warning people out there that were looking with night vision and that sort of thing. They expected it, though. So they expected to be boarded, which is why they would be going so fast in bad weather, take that left and get to Iranian waters as fast as they could. So they expected it. Yeah.
Wow.
It was a good time.
I've interviewed many SEALs and they've talked about many jobs, but I never really thought about that job. God, that sounds hairy because, everyone's greatest nightmare is to fall into the ocean at night.
Not interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
And especially during bad weather, but especially right next to a big ship.
From a great height, yeah.
And you got to throw
that. I had that experience.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. I don't think I've ever talked about this before because most people, we talk about Iraq, we talk about Afghanistan, we talk about direct action missions and sniper missions. So no one really ever asks about this. But so afterward, after you turn that big ship around, so Class 3 tankers are the gigantic like oil tankers that you see off the coasts of the United States, the ones that come in, gigantic cargo ships. So you turn that thing around, takes a little while, and you get it out there in international waters, and then you bring on what's called a prize crew. And these guys are people who actually know how to drive these big ships. The SEALs, we don't know. We're just knuckle draggers turning this thing around, getting it out of Iranian waters, and get it to a place where the prize crew comes on. And these are people from the regular Navy that actually know how to run these things. And then we would turn it over to
the side of a tanker, the side of the ship's got to be five stories, right? I mean,
they're big. They're huge.
It's big.
Huge. Yeah. Okay. They're huge.
Sorry.
Sometimes you have to do multiple. Yeah, you have to do multiple hooks to get up there. So it's crazy. But at the end of one of these, we get back on our little boats, and then we go back to a bigger boat that then takes us to this large amphibious ship that we're working off of. So middle of the night, you know, the seas are still terrible. You have to get back from this little rubber boat onto this bigger thing called a Mark V, kind of like a PT boat. That's the best way to describe it. And then as I was stepping across to get onto this PT boat thing, this Mark V hit this wave and with all my stuff, I was the radio guy. I had the radio, my rifle, full loadout of gear, everything went right between the two, middle of the night. My platoon chief thought that was the last that he was ever going to see of me. But the interesting thing is that my one and only thought was, hey, if I have to drop this radio that has crypto in it, meaning if you lose crypto, then everybody in the theater has to change their crypto and all their radios. And they'll know that a SEAL lost crypto. And so I'm like, I can't drop this pack. I have to swim it. So I swam this thing up just because I didn't want people to make fun of me for losing the crypto in the middle of the Northern Arabian Gulf at night. Mm-hmm. And boat turned around, came back, and they got me out of there. But yeah, it was a good time.
I love shame as a motivator.
It is a big motivator.
Yeah.
I almost chose death over shame. Yeah,
I wish there was more of that. We were talking at the top of the show about John Popper, who likes from Blues Traveler, who likes his guns, and we're talking about range. And now you're a sniper. You were a sniper. What kind of range did they want you to have as a sniper? And where was the kind of Mason-Dixon line of "I'm not taking this shot because I'm too far out"? What was that distance?
Yeah, well, it more depends on the weather conditions, the wind and those sorts of things, rather than the distance. The distance is important, of course, but then you have other factors. So a distance in perfect weather with no wind or anything like that is different than full value wind coming from an angle that can throw your round off target. So there's a lot of factors in there, and each one depends on the weapon system that you're using. So for a 50 cal, which we use the bolt action Remington 700 and Macmillan 50 cal, that was about 1,600 yards was about what you would be comfortable taking a shot at. So a mile, essentially, with that one.
Wow. Yeah.
Other things like a 300 Win Mag, which was really our workhorse, that was about 1,400. And you felt comfortable out to 1,200. Yeah. Then a 308 or 7.62, you're comfortable. You get dope out to about 1,200, but you're comfortable to 1,000. So each one of those different weapon systems has a different effective range.
Wow.
What would you – Brian's got a question, but first – when you're looking through the scope a mile out with the bolt action 50 cal, what are you really seeing through the scope? I mean, how much of your target are you just seeing their torso? Are you seeing their whole body? Like, what are you looking at a mile out with that bolt
action? That's more like an aerial weapon. So you have a scope that is more powerful than the one that you have on your other weapon systems, obviously, because you're shooting farther. You can zoom that thing in. But because you zoom in on those things, that means that if you bump it at that kind of a distance, then I remember it getting very difficult to find your target again, because you've zoomed in like this, all of a sudden you bump in and you're over here, and then you have to go back over here rather than having a larger field of view, being able to see what's going on. So if you're off, you still see your target and you just come back on. So there's a lot of factors at play there. But that one's more what we'd call an area weapon at that range. So you're taking out an engine block, you're taking out a plane, something like that. We use them to take out the speakers that were on these on buildings in Iraq, particularly in the campaign to retake Najaf in the summer of 2004. It was a two-week campaign of urban combat the entire time, and that was against the Muqtada al-Sadr's militia, and that called the Jaish al-Mahdi militia. And they were communicating through this system where they would just talk. So they're speaking Arabic through these speakers, so you can hear it, and they're talking and maneuvering forces via this network. And so we would shoot the speakers with the 50 cal off these the side of these buildings. So it was very very effective. In doing that.
Wow. Wow.
Brian, did you have a question?
Yeah, I imagine the Navy SEAL sniper community is fairly small. Did you know Chris Kyle? Did you serve with them? Do you know him?
Yeah, so we didn't meet. I never met him. He took over from us in Ramadi in 2006, but I'd already moved on to do another special program in Baghdad, so we never
physically crossed paths. Yeah. What's that? I said podcast or a real...
Yeah, it was a podcast. I needed to jump on, so I had to get over there.
Did you find movies like American Sniper like realistic, accurate, true to what you experienced? Because that's all we know about the whole experience.
Right. So whoever did the set design on that movie did a fantastic job, because that's what Ramadi 2005, 2006 looked like. Whoever did that, they got that right. They got the uniforms right, that sort of thing. They missed up a couple things. Like, he calls home in the middle of a firefight, calls his wife. Like that part, not so much. You'd definitely get kicked out of the unit and sent home for doing that.
Call the girlfriend for sure.
Yeah, that's a strange time to pick to call home on the sat phone. But then they also got right what it feels like to come home, the way they visually told that story. Yeah. Of him coming home. I think he's was watching TV. There's nothing on
that's,
it, I think.
That's the like scene that. I always refer to whenever that movie it gets brought up. That scene is so chilling. You see him and you
powerful.
Hear the sounds of war, like he's watching it on TV, and you turn around and the TV's off.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So they got that part right. You're fighting in the streets of Iraq or Afghanistan one day, and then less than 24 hours later, you're home and you're maybe changing your first diaper, you're going through some bills, you're feeling a leaky faucet, like all these things that you weren't focused on downrange, because downrange, you have your best friends to your right and left, your teammates, you're focused on the mission at hand, and you're not worried about any of those things. And then you come home and they're on your plate again.
Mm-hmm. How would you assess the skill level of the American fighting force and the equipment versus some of the places you're in and what you're dealing with?
Yeah, that's really interesting, because the people you're fighting against are essentially, they're using AK-47s and variants. They're making their bombs. They're using the same RPGs that have been around for decades. And you have the most technologically superior equipment in the world. And look what we've been doing for the last 20 years. So it's interesting to think of it in those terms, those asymmetric type terms. But our equipment got very good over the last 20 years. When we first entered Iraq and Afghanistan, we'd come out of the Clinton years, and we were using some legacy type gear. There wasn't really anything to spur that innovation. So we learned a lot. We applied those lessons to our gear and our tactics, and we got very good over the last 20 years at war at the tactical level. Now at the strategic level. So up here, when we're talking about our politicians and senior level military leaders, not so much. For whatever reason, they seem unable to grasp what kind of a situation they're committing U.S. forces to. They don't understand the nature of the conflict in which they're engaged, and they haven't really learned over the years. So what we do on the battlefield at the tactical level is we're always learning. We're always adapting to the enemy. Enemy's always adapting to us. We're looking for gaps in the enemy's defenses. We're looking to capitalize on momentum, all these things. And then you have these senior level leaders that seem to just fail upward. So back in World War II, like George Marshall is known for the Marshall Plan after World War II. But really during World War II, what he did was fire everyone who did not meet standards. Anyone who did not perform, gone. And really in Vietnam, we started to see this change where people who didn't perform stayed in those positions. And not only did they stay in those positions, then they either retired to make a lot of money on different boards, or they moved up in the complex. So it's changed a lot over the years, and it hasn't moved back. People aren't held accountable really for performance at those senior levels these days. They fail up.
Well, Biden was talking about getting out of Afghanistan, right? Am I making that up?
No, you're not.
And yeah, no, come.
Is that a good thing? It's weird that these questions always seem to be unanswerable and we seem to be split. I'll tell you what's vexing to me in this country, but just in the world, someone goes, we got to raise taxes. We'll make more money. And then the other economist goes, no, you cripple the economy. Right. Can we just get an answer to whether this helps or doesn't help? Right. And then you go, we need to pull troops out of Afghanistan. Some of those people were there, some of those people's kids are there. And again, what are we doing? It's an endless war. And then someone else goes, are you crazy?
Yeah.
The whole regional destabilized.
Why can't we have an expert? I mean, is it all political? Can we not arrive at an answer?
What is your humble and everything?
What is your opinion about pulling out of Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think it's time to it's time to leave. Hopefully, we have put in place different networks that allow us to keep tabs on what's going on there. We've had 20 years to establish different intelligence networks to get human intelligence sources over there at various levels. So say if we went in 2001, 2002, 2003, you establish a source over there who is now not 25 years old anymore. Now he's moved his way up and he's a senior level person. So hopefully our intelligence services have been smart enough to do this. And I hope they have, and I would think they have been. But at the same time, we went in there to destroy Al-Qaeda, to disrupt Al-Qaeda operations. We did that a lot faster than most people thought we could at the time. And then we took on this extra burden of nation building. We decided that we were going to combat corruption in Afghanistan. We were going to do all these things. We're going to look at sanctuaries in Iran and Pakistan. So we're going to do all these things that really have no end to them. You can spend the rest of your life trying to combat the political system and instill these different the Western ideas of democracy into Afghanistan, and you might never get there. So you could spend 50 years, 100 years doing that very same thing. So you have to come to a point where, hey, did we destroy Al-Qaeda? Do we inhibit their operations enough where we can bring people home, where we don't have to stay here forever? And I think we hit that a long time ago. But hopefully we have these intelligence networks still set up there. And also the world has changed. Before September 11th, in the 90s, 80s, you needed a physical place to train. So Bekaa Valley, of course, was one of those places. Hezbollah trained. Afghanistan was one. Sudan was one. There's these different places around the world where you physically needed to go and train and learn these things. Well, now, since 2001, we can do that virtually. Mm-hmm. We can get on we can do a lot of this planning, a lot of this training in a virtual space. So those physical locations aren't as important as they were back in 2001. And like we talked about earlier, a lot of that planning didn't take place in Afghanistan. It took place in Hamburg and San Diego and these other places. So, so hopefully we're taking these lessons and applying them to future decisions in a way that makes us a little wiser, but I'm not hopeful.
Let me just get some clarity. Are we able to train virtually or are they able to train virtually? Are we both able to train virtually?
Yeah, I mean, we can both train virtually, but if you're a terrorist organization, you're recruiting someone online, then you don't need to get that person a plane ticket from, say, you know, Chicago through Germany to Tehran to then Kabul, you had to do maybe in the 90s or something like that, but early 2000s. Now, hey, you can go and visit, you can talk about it in a secure
Google Hangout.
Yeah, go to Google Hangouts or something like that. So there are spaces where you can do that sort of thing. And of course, we're looking at that, but the internet's a big place.
I got Rob Schneider's next film, which is Al-Qaeda IT.
Oh, wow. That's good.
Yeah. He's the bumbling guy. Yeah. He's coming in there. They're always telling him. He gets recruited by the CIA, but he doesn't have any training at all. They're pissed off because the virtual training is not going well.
And I don't know if this is going to help at all. Something. I think he might be part Filipino.
Oh, he can do any accent.
Yeah, good.
Any accent. So, sorry, Gene, were you going to ask?
I am curious. When you were over there, were you married or did you have kids yet?
I did. So I didn't have kids initially, but I was married and we're still married today. So
God bless you.
One of the few. Yeah, there's marriages take a hit.
I wonder about that. Well, I'm thank you for your candor because I do wonder about that. I don't have any military in my family and I don't really know anyone. So the one question that I can't ever process is how can a marriage survive something like this or why would you put yourself through this it feels so counterintuitive to, you know, to be married and then go bye, I'm going to this super dangerous place, I can't tell you where I'm going and I don't know when I'll be back.
Yeah, no, it's tough because the pendulum has to be on the side of the team. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to be able to talk to your spouse about that. And they have to be on board with it because especially as a leader, that's what you owe the people you're taking downrange. That's what you owe their families. That's what you owe the mission. That's what you owe the country. That pendulum has to be on that team. And if you're talking to your spouse about it, for us anyway, we talked about eventually when I'm out of the military, that pendulum's swinging back to focus on the family again. But you have to have a spouse partner that is on board knowing that they are second. And that's just how it has to be. They are 100% second. Your family is second to the team. Mm-hmm. And they have to be on board with that. They have to know that.
When you came back,
that's tough. Not everybody can do it.
Oh, sure. And I wonder, I mean, I don't know if you experienced this, but I'm sure it's on some level, like you said, the adjustment, I don't know if it was post-traumatic stress or just that adjustment period. Was your wife understanding to that?
I think the only time I had a hard time coming back was after that deployment in 2005, 2006. So it was a very busy time in Iraq, and it was one of the best deployments I ever had. It was amazing. We're doing the work every single night. I was attached to it's called the Covert Action Unit that actually inspired my second novel, True Believer. But I got back from that, and I wanted to be back. So I was just thinking, I was like, oh man, I wanted to be back. What are the guys doing tonight? Wow. What's happening? And my wife was like, hey, snap out of it. I was like, oh, okay. Mm. So that's all it took for us. But other than that, I was usually very good at coming back and flipping that switch and then going from being downrange, doing that job, kicking those doors in the middle of the night to now coming home and realizing that, okay, it's time to get back into training and also balance the family and all that stuff. But knowing that, hey, my job now is to take those lessons that I learned on the battlefield, pass those along to the people that we're training up now and getting ready to go downrange with and being a better operator, a better combat leader because of that experience. So you have to be all in all the time on that if you're in the military. And of course, my experience is very slim in special operations. That was the focus. So I'll speak to that. But in special operations, that has to be your focus. Wow.
The Terminal List is one of your books that's filming a new TV series for your first book. And Chris Pratt is starring an executive producer.
That's right.
Talk about that. That's exciting.
Yeah. What's crazy is that as I was writing the book, so as I started to get out of the military, that pendulum started to come back. So I realized I'm getting out. I drop, which it's called dropping your papers. And when you do that, you tell the military you're getting out and they put you in a different pile, which means that you have to now get out of this gigantic bureaucracy and you have to stand in a lot of lines. So you go to medical and you go to dental and you go turn in gear and you get right out of secret programs. And to do each one of these things, you have to make an appointment, which are more lines. So you have essentially a year of waiting in line to do all these things, which gave me time to write. And since I was a little kid, I knew that I wanted to write. I grew up surrounded by books and this love of reading. My mom was a librarian. And I knew that was my next thing. So I started writing. And I thought, you know, who's going to play this character? Chris Pratt. Wow. And I just had that thought. And he'd only been Andy Dwyer on Parks and Rec, and he had a very small role in Zero Dark Thirty.
I was about to ask about that, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So there was something there. I was like, he had this one role. I was like, who's the guy that's this generation's Tom Hanks? Because in the 80s, remember Tom Hanks, Bosom Buddies, he's doing all the comedy. And then he takes a risk with Philadelphia.
Right.
And from then, he could do anything else that he wanted. I was like, who's that guy that needs to take a risk that's kind of known for being more fun and that sort of thing? Because I need a likable character as well. And I thought, that's Chris Pratt.
And willing to drop a few pounds.
Back then, exactly.
I mean, same as Tom Hanks, right?
Yeah, that's for Castaway.
That's right.
Well, Philadelphia.
Oh, and Philadelphia, right?
Come on, Gene.
Yep.
Jesus Christ.
Yep, big time.
Sorry,
big
I didn't
time.
Love that movie as much as you guys do.
And so what was crazy, though, is that I had no connection to him, no connection to anybody in Hollywood. And then right before the book came out, well, like 4 months before it comes out, I get this call from an old buddy of mine in the SEAL teams, and I hadn't talked to him in about 5 years. And he says, hey, I always wanted to call you and thank you for what you did for me in the SEAL teams. And I couldn't even remember what it was. And he said, you sat me down, you talked to me about transition, you introduced me to people in the private sector. Nobody else took the time to do that. And I always wanted to thank you. And I said, no problem. And then he said, I heard you have a book coming out. And I said, yeah, I have a book coming out. I can send you a rough draft. It comes out in a few months. And he said, well, I'd like to give it to a friend of mine. And I'm like, yeah, no problem. Who's that? And he said, Chris Pratt. And so Chris read it in December of 2017. And January 2018, he called and wanted to option it. So,
nice.
So yeah, we were off to the races. And now we're filming. And Antoine Fuqua was directing. And it's 350 people on set there in LA. And it's incredible to see it all come together. It's completely surreal.
What network, if that's even a term anymore, is it going to be on?
Amazon Prime. Sometime in 2022. But
and it's shooting in LA?
In LA.
That's good to know.
It's crazy.
Harbinger of good things.
Yeah, it's amazing to be out there and seeing how they do all the stunts. And it's very much like a military operation. You have Kraft Food Services is like the Army logistics chain feeding everybody. You have the explosives guy there. You have the mobility transportation guy moving the cars around just like we have in the platoon. You have the weapons guy you're trading your weapons with, and he's marking off as the actors get back and hand them in at the end of the day. And then you have Antoine as this like CO, the commanding officer, who's setting the tone up here. And you have Chris as like the platoon commander, troop commander at that tactical level, setting the tone there. So it's very much like a military operation.
Wow. What?
More fun.
It's so clairvoyant, prescient, I guess, of you to...
Jack calls it Beshert.
Beshert, to be thinking about the guy from Parks and Rec playing that part.
Yeah.
And small in Zero Dark Third. I'm trying to...
It was a small part. He was part of SEAL Team 6, the last third of the movie. Remember, the Bin Laden raid.
Yeah.
Wow. Can you hang around with us and do some news with us, Jack?
Let's do it.
All right, let me hit Tommy John, and then we'll get in some news. Tommy John, man, the best. Oh, man, when you're wearing Tommy John's hammock pouch underwear, you're so much more comfortable. You do everything better. Tommy John doesn't have customers. They have fanatics. They've sold over 13 million pairs. I feel like I've said that for 9 months, so we got to be up to at least 14 million by now. I only wear Tommy John, and you will too. Dozens of comfort innovations like air mesh interior hammock, moisture wicking fabric with four times the stretch of competing brands. Once you've tried Tommy John, you're never going to go back to your former underwear. It is the best. I wear them every day, especially good if you're rowing on a rowing machine or hitting a cycle, you know, soul cycle or out jogging or being active. It's the best pair you'll ever wear. It's free, guaranteed, right, Dawson?
And right now, you get 20% off your first order at TommyJohn.com/Adam. That's 20% off your first order of underwear and loungewear at TommyJohn.com/Adam. TommyJohn.com/Adam. See site for details.
All right, we'll take a quick break. Jack Carr is going to hang with us. We'll be right back with the news right after this.
Give me the news with Grad. News with Gino Grad. Breaking viral, weird crime, protest, politics. Give me news with Gina Grad. Stuff they saw on TMZ. Joe Biden, Kamala. Meet news with Gina, Gina Grad.
The news with Gina Grad.
Hey, yeah. What? Quick question for Jack.
Yes, sir.
In terms of people acclimating when they come back from the theater of operations back here. I'm not an expert in this because I never served. I was never a Navy SEAL, but I have been around a little bit, did a lot of construction, played a lot of Pop Warner football. Does it drive you insane what incredible pussies everyone has turned into in this fucking country? Like, I have zero tolerance for everyone turning into a giant gaping snatch. It's fucking ridiculous. If you're over a certain age and you've been on a construction site and you played some ball and you've ridden a motorcycle, it just feels like everyone is just a fucking colossal puss. And for you, it must be 1,000 times what I experience on a daily basis.
I mean, I totally understand exactly. I mean, I understand exactly what
you're
talking about.
You don't know my pain.
You boxed. Yeah. I mean, you boxed too. I boxed growing up as well. And, you know, being in that ring, that's one of the hardest. When I was in Buds, actually, I thought about being in the ring. I thought about early days in jiu-jitsu in the early 90s when Brazilian jiu-jitsu first got here and just how hard that ring time was, how hard that time on the mat was as I was going through SEAL training and Hell Week and all that sort of thing. But yeah, it does. And what I think about, what actually hurts more than that is just thinking about everything that people sacrificed from the inception of this country up until today to give us these freedoms, give us these opportunities. They sacrificed everything for us. And now here we are getting upset at this and that, and actually championing the curtailing of the freedoms that these people died for, that came back missing arms and legs from different battlefields around the world. So that's kind of what I think about more often than not, is just how sad that is.
All right, Jeannie, you can get on with your news. Buds is basic underwater demolition, right?
That's right. Buds. Basic underwater demolition SEAL training. Nice work.
Underwater demolition?
Boom.
Oh, yeah.
Boom. Damn. That's the hottest thing I've ever heard of.
I know.
Well, a St. Paul man has been sentenced to 41 months in prison for his role in the burning of the Minneapolis Police Department 3rd Precinct during protests last year. 23-year-old Brandon Wolf, along with a crowd of hundreds gathered at the 3rd Precinct on May 28th last year, pushed a barrel into a fire located in the entrance of the 3rd Precinct headquarters with the intent to accelerate the existing fire. Wolf was arrested in June of last year while he was wearing several stolen items and pleaded guilty last December.
I know where I got this Kango hat. Don't ask.
To one count of conspiracy.
I'm just saying as an example. Could have been any hat.
You asked me if I wanted to know, and I say don't ask.
Don't ask.
And talk about an empty bag. Along with his prison sentence, Wolf was sentenced to 2 years of supervised release and ordered to pay $12 million in restitution. And he's not alone. Last week, another man, Dylan Shakespeare Robinson, was sentenced to 4 years of prison, pleading guilty to one count of conspiracy to commit arson as well in the burning of the precinct. He also ordered 2 years of supervised release, $12 million restitution.
I bet he could only rustle up like 8.7.
Yeah, 8.5 maybe.
Without a little more advanced notice.
I think you're right.
Pick up a lot of litter on the side of the highway.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus Christ. Well, good.
I mean, is that just a, what, just so we can say what? You're not going to get $24 million if you do that.
Well, I think it's like what we do when we give a guy like 14 consecutive life sentences.
Yeah.
It's like
a message.
Yeah. You're just going, you're going to die in prison.
Right.
I mean, that's how we do the law.
And you'll never be able to work hard enough to pay this money back.
Right.
A series of love letters handwritten by President John F. Kennedy to his Swedish mistress are going up for sale at a Boston auction house, according to CNN. The intimate letters addressed to Gunilla von Post. She's an aristocrat he met weeks prior to his marriage to Jackie. Revealed
Gina,
Kennedy. Yeah.
As a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Series of love letters. You finding a series of love letters mm-hmm. that your man is writing to his mistress.
Ew.
Worse than finding the back of his sack when you come walking in and he's fucking her, right?
Yes.
As a guy, we don't want to see that. But as a woman, a series of love letters,
And you can burn them, you can tear them up, doesn't take that sting away, doesn't take the
it's the effort.
Yeah, you can see the penmanship when you close your
eyes. Because you guys are all about effort.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The fucking
part. We don't
want
Tori Amos's old flowers.
Yeah, that's happened to me.
That happened to Adam. I mean,
she's a looker.
We don't want to see. Yeah, we have a picture of her, actually.
But also, Jackie... He's probably thinking about the time that for their anniversary, he just sent a Secret Service guy out to buy some flowers from the Mexican guy at the gas station or something.
So he could see Marilyn.
They have
Monroe.
A rose garden, for God's sake. You think
he dispatched someone from the kitchen to go pick something. She knows. It's effort, right?
You're absolutely right. And we have a picture of her. She was quite fetching.
Ooh, la, la.
The 8-page collection, which includes one full letter and 2 partial messages, come from Von Post's personal collection. They're expected to fetch about $30,000. She died in 2011. Prior to her death, though, she wrote a memoir about her relationship with him called Love, Jack.
He had a lot of
concubines.
Yeah. Conquests.
He had a lot because I've seen a few people interviewed on him.
Yeah. And it's funny. I mean, isn't that kind of how it went with Martin Luther King?
Like, just kind of how it went. It turns out.
Yeah. Who'd have thunk it?
We're not doing a retroactive Me Too, but he, for a guy with a bad back, he fucked a lot of strangers. You know what I mean? If you're banging your wife with a bad back, you can lay it out. Like, all right, here's the positions I can do. You understand with the sciatica and whatever.
This is Cirque du
Soleil. I need you to sign this.
I'm not trying to prove anything to anyone.
Right. But when you're with the Swedish models, 22.
Good luck.
You can't go in there holding the domes.
You're the Prez? No way, man.
Yeah.
A hemorrhoid donut. That's to bring his A game.
Wow. $30,000.
Do
we know what the letters said?
Do we have... I didn't see any photographs. There weren't any photographs in the archive of the letters.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully we can rustle that up because I'd be interested as well. Unfortunately for France, that country just got a little bit smaller.
You know what?
Yeah.
Cheating used to just be a thing like you had, like polio. You know what I mean? Like, he loves the ladies.
Yeah.
He's married to
one. Wandering eye.
Oh, you know, he's a man about town. It's like, okay, I guess it's just some condition he got, and he just fucks strangers.
What are you going to do?
He loves ladies.
What can be done?
Yeah.
You know, so I read today that the trust in government was at its height in the early time, prior of JFK's presidency. So I'm not saying there's a direct correlation here between these two events, between trust in government and the mistress there. But, I mean, I'm not saying that there's not either.
That's interesting.
Well, you know, they say it's like the highest pressure job in the world. They always talk about how it ages everyone.
Yeah, everyone turns gray.
It didn't age Trump for some reason, but everyone turns – he just looked like shit at the beginning. Yeah. But – you see these guys getting gray. It's like so stressful. Well, you know, if you could argue that, well, you should take saunas and steam baths and get a massage. You know, you need stress reduction here.
Self-care.
That's banging an intern in the pool, you know?
If that's what he's got to do, he's running the free world.
That's what I'm saying.
Question, and I would love...
We have a Kennedy letter from 19... 19-
Is this the one?
Yeah, and the penmanship is awful, but it's. I must say, I was sad to learn that.
Yeah, you ever tried writing with a boner? You got to try it.
Now it makes sense.
It's so
literally
good.
With the boner, that's hard.
I must say that I was sad to learn that, after all, you are not coming to the U.S.
No.
If you don't marry, come over, as I should like to see you. I had a wonderful time last summer with you. It is a bright memory of my life. I am anxious to see you. Is it not strange after all these months? Perhaps at first it shall be a little difficult, as we shall be strangers, but not strangers. And I am sure it will all work, and I shall think that, though it is a long way to Goodnilla, it is worth it.
Yeah, that's
wow.
Her name.
Okay, time has passed.
Is that, that's 1956. When was he married?
He was a senator at that point, right? Because he was elected in 1960.
Yeah, it's on senator paper here.
Oh, so this has been going on for a while because this was, Goodnilla came into the picture in 1953, according to this article.
Hmm. But when did he marry Jackie?
1953, right?
I have no idea.
I don't know. I mean, somewhere in that time.
He met her, this article says.
At his wedding?
Prior to his 19, oh, even before, prior to his 1953 marriage to Jackie.
Oh, okay.
Damn.
All right.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at least he's faithful, I
guess.
Loves
the ladies.
Mistresses. Yeah. A Belgian farmer moved a 330-pound stone on his property just so he could make room for his tractor to go by. But what he didn't realize is that he actually moved the border between Belgium and France. Local historians were recently walking the area and noting a line of stone markers which had been placed there, the 200-year-old border between the two countries. They noticed that one of the stones had been moved onto the French side, thus expanding the size of Belgium by 7 feet. While the town in Belgium was happy to have the space, the French town on the other side did ask him to move it back. The farmer was told to move the stone or he would be charged and fined.
Jack, what do you know about the Maginot Line?
Ooh, yeah, you don't want to be there. Yeah, I know that. I know that.
The French... Yeah, sorry.
Tell us.
The French built this thing called the Maginot Line, like after World War One, and they decided to build this great wall with all these tracks and ways to move mm-hmm. armament and stuff, and keep, you know, if Hitler got mm-hmm. a little nutty or another
over,
European
yeah.
country, and they built all this stuff to move all this stuff to make their stuff sort of impenetrable, and then the Blitzkrieg came and they just flew right over it and bombed the shit out of France.
Because it was from the early 30s, right?
They probably started the Maginot Line in after World War One. Yeah, probably in like the early 30s, and they weren't thinking about Stukas and
how could
and
they?
Nice work,
and,
geniuses.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's all about adaptation. Yeah, all about adaptation. You know, the enemy's always looking at us; we're always looking at them, and the Germans adapted. Yeah,
Max Spada, find me the Maginot Line and like how long it was, and what it was on the border of France and not Belgium. Maybe I don't know. And it didn't work.
Didn't work.
No.
That's
but
the lesson.
They put a lot of time into it. It just didn't pay off. We should move it to the Mexican border out here. We should see if we can move the Maginot Line out there.
Something else that doesn't work?
Yeah.
It is constructed on the French side of its borders with Italy, Switzerland, Germany, and Luxembourg.
And what year was it?
1929 to 1938 was when they were building it.
Yeah. It's a big, big project. And I think they had like tunnels and railways and stuff, and they could move troops. And the whole plan was we're going to move troops where we need them, and we're going to move cannons where we need them. It's all in this railroad and this
great,
fortified.
Great
and
plan.
Germans just rolled right over it.
Whoopsie.
Whoopsie.
Question for Jack. I feel like it would
I watch
have come
a
up.
Lot of the History Channel, in case,
in case you're wondering.
You don't know.
We were talking about how fast presidents go gray, mm-hmm. and it's always been my thinking that part of that is because they're given all the secrets to all the extraterrestrial stuff.
The burden of knowledge.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Jack, any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know about the extraterrestrial part, but in my latest novel, I did some research into this. So in The Devil's Hand, I did some research into this.
It's all bullshit.
because I needed a character that was in, that made his way to the presidency, had a background, comes from a very wealthy family, gets into early tech startup stuff. 9/11 happens. His fiance is killed in the tower. So he devotes himself to the military, goes to 10th Mountain Division, is wounded overseas, comes back. But the whole point of all this is so he can find out information that the rest of us don't have, because the president doesn't have a security clearance. The president can look at anything that they want. President probably wouldn't pass a security check like the rest of us have to get in the military, or that FBI agents or CIA operatives have to get. So that was the whole point of the novel. So yes, the presidents do have access to really anything that they want, but they have to know what to ask for. So no one just walks in and says, here's all the secrets. What do you want to look at?
Give me aliens.
You have to know. Yeah, you exactly. Alien stuff. So if you have to actually know where to look, what to ask for, those sorts of things. And you can task people, of course, but if you don't know the questions to ask, then you don't get those kind of answers that you're looking for. So, it was definitely interesting. So it's a character that people really like.
I believe I heard somewhere that maybe it's as soon as June 15th, but they're going to turn over all of what they know about UFOs, the government.
Oh, boy.
Is.
Do we like this or not? Or are you going to – is everyone going to be so jaded that no one's going to care like I think they will?
Speaking personally, I grew up – I'm older than you guys. I grew up all around UFO talk, mm-hmm. and all movies about UFOs and lots of TV shows about UFOs and a lot of obsession with UFOs. Recently, some footage has come out taken from some ships and some planes about stuff that people are now confirming as UFOs, and I'm not that interested.
Oh, God.
I have no idea why.
Yeah, short of an alien corpse, like, I don't know if I want to just say, like, oh, something was spotted over so-and-so, like, eh.
But I think I heard that June, for some reason, I have the date June 15th in my head or something, but that the White House and the government was just going to go, we're going to...
Okay, now
turn over what we
now
got.
Let's go down this conspiracy rabbit hole, because my first question is why? Why now? What are they distracting us from?
That's a good point.
That is, we're all going to be like, whoa, somebody saw something one time. What are we not looking at that we
President
should be looking
Kamala's
at?
President Kamala's what's going to happen. That's right.
Or maybe there's a whole shitload of real scary UFO stuff, and they go, we're just going to give you everything we got, and it's a bunch of nothing.
Right.
Maybe then we're quelled.
Yeah, I don't
know.
But imagine if this had come out in like 1985 or something like that. We would be so much more interested. Have a Geraldo special on it where he's going to unveil something.
Yes.
You know, it'd be this whole thing. And now we're like, just add it to the list of craziness from the last year. We're totally, it's. I'm with you. You know, it's just like, okay, it's another thing.
That, if I told my kids I have a UFO corpse, they wouldn't look up from their phone. Chris, can you find that date? Am I making that up? That's something. There's some proclamation that the government is going to share what they know.
Well, he's looking.
And sometimes
for that.
Sometimes they talk about these dates, and then, like with the JFK stuff, I think Trump said he was going to let. There's still these files that have not been opened from the JFK assassination, and he had a date on the calendar, and he was going to open them up. And then I think he got a visit from a couple people from the CIA, who they always say. To protect sources and methods, we can't let this stuff out. So I think he let a couple of them open, but not everything.
Ted
so it's
Cruz
crazy how that happens. They put these dates on, and then they don't follow up. They distract you with something else.
Tangential question: as long as we're talking about presidents and military and everything, isn't it crazy how, considering the president is the commander in chief, how little military experience matters now in electing a president?
He doesn't need any.
None.
He or she, Gina.
That's right.
Thank you.
That's right. So, I was talking to a congressman yesterday, actually, about how the percentage, and he told me the percentage of people with military experience in Congress, and I think he said 13%, which surprised me. I thought it would be a lot lower, actually, these days, which is different. If you go back, it was a lot different, obviously, after World War II. There's a lot more experience in there. So it is semi-shocking how many people get into – I shouldn't say it is shocking because the people want that power and control, but how little they experience, real-world experience they actually have. What they understand is politics and power. They don't even understand the Constitution or the history behind why we have some of these amendments to the Constitution, or why we have some of the laws in place that we do, or some – things, some laws that maybe that aren't in place or shouldn't be in place. So the perspective that a lot of our elected leaders have is really based these days off tweets rather than on a deep dive into the requisite time, energy, and effort that they should be putting into the study of history so they can apply those lessons going forward in a way that benefits the country. But instead, it's all about tweets and power these days.
I would take, as a taxpayer, I would take, you must have military experience and or have run a restaurant or a B&B for more than 19 months. I need some sort of boots on the ground. Right. Like running a restaurant, if you told me, oh, this guy ran a chain of restaurants for 10 years, I'd go, okay, that's a guy who understands budget and time and allocations, not like weird pie in the sky.
Right.
You know, I feel like omelets deserve a place. That's a real, there's inventory, then you got to deal.
No one's buying it, 86 it.
Yeah, you have to deal with the staff. Yeah. It's always a constant thing. The customer, the taxpayers got to be happy. Like I would take running that, and it made me think of that famous I think it was a George McGovern thing where he was in politics for a long time, and then he got out and he got on the speaking circuit, and then he saved up his money, and then he went to go open a B&B. He went to go open a B&B, and it failed. And then when he was done, he was like, I wish I knew half the shit when I was a politician. I wouldn't have made all these rules.
Oh, my God.
Like, I didn't know what it was like to try to run a business. All I did was make rules for people who tried to run a business. Whew. But if I'd known then what I know now, I wouldn't have made all those rules.
And either serving in the military in some capacity or running some sort of a business is not a bridge too far. It's not a lot to ask that somebody was somehow involved in military service or somehow managed a business.
I would like that.
I think the business is more important than the military service, especially if they get up. Because once they hit these certain ranks, you essentially become a politician in uniform. Not everybody, but a lot of people. So let's say you're an admiral or a general sitting there at the Pentagon, and you see your buddy who just got out 2 years earlier sitting on the board of Raytheon, attending one meeting a year for $1 million or whatever he's making for that one meeting he's in. Maybe when that Raytheon contract comes across, maybe you're more apt to sign that. Mm. I mean, that's a real thing. That military-industrial complex is a real thing. And these guys definitely... Definitely, well, I shouldn't say everybody, a lot become politicians in uniform when they hit a certain rank. So I take the restaurant guy as president over the military guy any day of the week.
UFO report given deadline. What do we got? June?
So it was given a deadline of June 1st, but I'm seeing it's actually a 180-day countdown from when Trump approved the spending package on December 27th, which makes it June 25th. But they said
it's way off my June 15th.
Yeah. And, but they said that there are two factors, that it could come sooner or it can also be delayed. That's what they're saying. I mean, I don't know what it means.
Well, there's some move.
I got to know.
To find out
what's
out there. Yeah.
Peloton has agreed to recall all of its Tread and Tread Plus machines after an accident killed a 6-year-old child. There have been 72 reports of people, pets, or objects being pulled under the rear of the treadmill with 29 injuries. CEO John Foley has apologized for the company's initial resistance to the request for a recall. He says Peloton made a mistake in our initial response to the Consumer Product Safety Commission's request that we recall the Tread Plus. We should have engaged more productively.
Die kind of that way,
wasn't it? Was strangulation or drowning?
Hooked up in a pull thing, but I think for some reason there's.
I don't know. It was on a treadmill, and it was obviously years ago for Peloton. But
on a treadmill, but got hooked into the pull. Yeah, bad times.
Yeah. So now does Christy have one?
She has a Peloton bike.
Of course she does. Mm. God forbid she can't get her 4 a.m. workout in
by our ceiling to floor window.
Got it. That's smart. Fewer American women are having babies, according to me, and according to a new report released today. The U.S. birth rate fell 4% last year, the largest single year decrease in 50 years. Wow. Experts blame the drop on a combination of money troubles and fear for the future with the pandemic. There were about 3.6 million births last year as compared to 3.75 million the year before. The birth rate has been steadily dropping since 2007 when there were 4.3 million births.
Good. Less people.
I mean,
I I've talked to Drew about this. He's interviewed some guys about this. This is more testosterone and sperm count dropping and all that stuff. And there's some pretty smart people who think it has to do with all the plastic in our world.
Really? I just assumed.
How could you think about going from zero plastic, you know, like kind of as a species, you know, drinking stuff out of gourds and clay pots and iron skillets and stuff, to ubiquitous plastic? Just every part inside your car, everything you're holding, all that you're drinking out of is food storage. I mean, it is ubiquitous plastic in our environment. Yeah. Now, I could see that mussing the flora and the fauna a little bit.
That absolutely makes sense. I was just assuming it was kind of that Idiocracy vibe. Remember how it started of like, you know, people are waiting longer and getting their education and having less kids. And like, and then some people are just going, you know, gone wild, having all, you know, so it's like, I think that most anecdotally, people I know are just older when they have kids. Well,
yeah, there's some of that.
Everything makes sense what you're saying. I remember, Chris can look this up if he wants to, but the birth rate fell during the, in the aftermath of the housing crisis of 08 and 09. Mm-hmm. And every time there's economic crises, birth rate falls. People, you know, money problems, whatever.
Because we were all expecting those quarantines in the next 10 years, but people that we thought, you know, it was all going to be everybody just staying home and fucking, but they weren't.
Well, this is a separate thing, but like I said, sperm count down, penis is getting smaller, I think, as well.
Come on.
Who are you speaking for?
And, take that, kids.
And, hey, that'd be a pretty good day if we could get the average down a couple of clicks. You know what I mean? Yeah, why not?
Yeah. Good day for us old guys, right?
King among men.
Yeah, I was talking to, I've heard some reports about it. Kind of makes sense. And it's also just kind of a generational thing. Like people don't aspire to get married and start a family and do that. They want to have a career and hang out and have a good time.
In the land of the blind, the one-eyed Willie is
right.
Monster.
That's right.
Well said.
All right, let's bring it home, Gina Grad.
You got it. I'm Gina Grad.
Yeah.
And that's the news.
Hey there.
Gina Grad.
That was the news with Gina Grad.
Jack Carr, the book is called The Devil's Hand, a thriller. Jack, I'm so impressed with your not only knowledge base, but your ability to convey it. It's such a, it's so concisely. You're really gifted.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for having me on. I was going to prepare for this conversation by going to watch The Hammer again, which is one of my favorites. I love that movie. So
he's obviously a genius.
My family to it.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And the kids here later. So, yeah, but now I'm going to zip over and do my little Fox spot here. I'm in the studio right now. But thank you guys so much for having me on. It's
thanks,
an honor,
Jack,
to be here.
Loved it.
We'll have you back, man. And thanks for enjoying The Hammer.
Absolutely. You guys take care. Thanks
take
for
care,
having me.
Jack. All right, let me tell you about Humble CBD. Need rest, relaxation after a long day at the office. Sick of soreness and inflammation? Let's talk about Humble CBD. Wide variety of hemp-derived CBD products. Twist, roll, and relax with your CBD calming balm. Or travel with their CBD twist and a tincture as well. On the go, smaller than a pack of gum, designed for your pocket. Humble CBD is focused on helping you stay grounded, no matter what life brings to you. Remember, a tree's beauty lies in its branches, but the strength is in the roots. Focus, relax, recover with Humble CBD. Right, Dawson?
Now offering 25% off your first order with promo code ADAM. All you have to do is go to humblecbd.com and choose any product that meets your needs. Stay grounded with Humble CBD.
I have never met a Navy SEAL that I didn't like.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, this guy could be a professor. Like, he's really, really good at explaining this stuff.
Yes. But there's just a, maybe as we get more sort of chaotic and unfocused, the kind of focus of SEALs. I love, they're so, because you think about it, it's the ultimate pragmatic job.
Yeah.
If you're not pragmatic,
it's
you're dead. You will not come back if you're not being pragmatic. All right. almost sold out Appleton, Wisconsin, Skyline Comedy Club. That's tonight and tomorrow. You can see if you can find a few tickets left. Dunnigan's going to be guesting on, or is going to be, well, guesting, I guess, yeah, on Saturday. Jam in the Van, we're all going to be there May 22nd out here in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Go to amcroll.com for all the live shows and No Safe Space, available now on Amazon Prime. Until next time, Adam Carolla for Gina Grad, Bald Brian, and Jack Carr saying mahalo.
You really fucked me.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow Ace on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. Catch Gina Grad with Teresa Strasser on the podcast. Strasser on the podcast. Easy listening. Bald Brian is on the show, The Film Vault. And me and Chris and Kaylin and Matt and Gary are in the water cooler. Check it out. You can also pre-order my new record, Mike Dawson and the Smoking Kills, right now at thesmokingkills.com. And pick up one of Adam's movies, tickets to a show, a book. Everything's up there at adamcarolla.com.
Hey, Geico, do you own? Do you rent? Well, you do one or the other, right? You know, it's hard work out there. Owning, renting. You want to save some money? How about you bundle? Bundle your policies at Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle the homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you got so much to do already. Go to geico.com, get a quote, see just how much you could save at Geico. That is geico.com today. That's geico.com.